The Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illness, written and read by Suzanne O'Sullivan. In 2018, Resignation Syndrome moved to Nauru, an island in the Pacific. At the time, Nauru was being used as a holding pen for refugees seeking asylum in Australia. True to the form of biopsychosocial disorders, the symptoms of Resignation Syndrome changed when it arrived in another continent. Here, children refused to eat. They expressed outright depression and desperation before they stopped moving. The Swedish children had slipped into a listless, apathetic world. They were passive. But the Nauru children's condition was an active cry for help. One young girl set herself on fire. Children begged to die. The medical condition had evolved to meet a more immediate, urgent need. Nauru is a tiny island. Its natural resources were destroyed by mining long ago, and its marine life culled by pollution. The children interned there had no way to move forward in their lives and had no idea where their futures lay. Their island home was more like a prison, complete with guards. Their chances of being admitted to Australia were slim. They could be sent back to the country they came from or offered asylum somewhere far away. As awful as the plight of the Swedish children clearly was, in Nauru it was much, much worse. By 2018, Resignation Syndrome had been widely reported in the world's press, so the spread to a related group half a world away was not surprising. In 2019, it spread again to the refugee camps on the Greek island of Lesbos. The question arises, what should be done to prevent future cases of Resignation Syndrome, and how should those already comatose or catatonic be treated? When I visited Nola, Helan, Flora and Kezia, they were lying inertly in their homes with no active intervention taking place. If this is a medical illness, then surely the children should be in hospital or, at the very least, they should be receiving intensive treatment at home. If they were European-born, if they were not refugees, society would expect a lot more for them. Or should the question be, is theirs even a medical illness? If it is a sociocultural phenomenon, then perhaps it is just about tolerable that the children wait at home while people like Dr. Olson call for a more definitive solution for them. If they were hospitalized and treated individually, they might stand a fighting chance of recovery. But where would that leave the underlying social problems that have created the disorder? Mario, my new mosquito friend, speculated that disorders like greasy sickness made girls strong who were otherwise weak. I came to regard Resignation Syndrome as a language of distress that speaks louder than words. Would treating the symptoms of Resignation Syndrome without addressing the root cause ultimately rob the community of their voice and the children of their strength? If Resignation Syndrome was abolished, how would the message about the plight of asylum-seeking children get out? Clear statements of distress and standard calls for help do not seem to be enough. As I watch Resignation Syndrome advance around the world, and as I hear of new outbreaks of psychosomatic illness taking hold of brand new groups of people, I despair of the havoc they wreak and how poorly understood they are. When I started writing this book, I had a naive hope that offering people an understanding of the types of physiological mechanisms thought to create functional disability would somehow help protect against them. Then I started listening to people's stories. For once, not as their doctor, and freed of the obligation to cure them. As a result, I found a new perspective that made me wonder if eradicating these disorders was, in fact, the wrong thing to hope for. For many of the people I met, psychosomatic illness served a vital purpose. Seizures solved a sociocultural problem for the Miskito and Wapishana people. In Krasnogorsk, a sleeping sickness did the same. Psychosomatic and functional disorders break the rules of every other medical problem because, for all the harm they do, they are sometimes indispensable. There are simply not enough words to express everything a person feels. The complexity of human emotions cannot be distilled into something rational and well thought out for every person in every situation. Cognitive dissonance exists, as do moral dilemmas, inconceivable choices, inequality, and despair. Life will always find a way to set traps that seem impossible to escape. People are not machines, making decisions from algorithms, logical and free of emotion. So perhaps we need release valves and coping mechanisms, face-safing ways of addressing conflict and grappling with ambivalence. Sometimes embodying and enacting conflict is either more manageable or more practical than articulating it.